Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and joining me since we were at the Land of Edgelock is James.
That's right.
Yeah. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up on our most recent episodes. Our most recent episode was about The Towering Inferno. Before that was Mank. Before that was Tenet, Memories of Murder, and Jordan Peele's Us. Yeah, at themacguffinmen.com, and you can follow us at themacguffinmen on Twitter. All right, James, here we are talking about the third Hollywood foray by by one Damien Chazelle.
Yeah, first I guess man. We have covered his whole career.
We didn't do Guy and Madeline.
Yeah, I know, but as you said, Hollywood.
Yeah, we when you're like a really talented auteur, the first film only counts if it is really amazing. That's just kind of how it goes. Like if it's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, then everybody has to see it. If it's Guy and Madeline sitting on a park bench, it's you know, we don't do a podcast on it,
right? And it was a pretty musical one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so First Man, it seems to be least tied to music, but it's still a movie that I found had some very wonderful musical parts. And as you said, the Edgelock musical,
yes, of course,
clearly made by Damien Chazelle, the music lover.
Mm-hmm.
But still, very much a departure from. I mean, I didn't know what he would do next, but even he said he liked doing something that was the opposite of La La Land. So, you know, there is the music important in there, but this is just a significantly different movie than what the first two films gave us to expect.
Yeah,
right?
For sure. And I think like the difference between Whiplash and La La Land is pretty huge as well. It's just that they both involve jazz music, you know, and but stylistically, they're vastly different movies, and tonally, they're incredibly different movies as well. And I think this follows with that tradition of changing up the style and changing up the tone.
Yeah, and if you can do that successfully, especially at the beginning of your career, that's a very good sign.
Yeah, exactly. if you're the youngest Best Director winner ever, chances are you're doing something right.
Yes.
Right. So where do we start with Mr. First Man?
Well, I think this was a suggestion of yours, so you can explain maybe what you thought was compelling about it.
Oh yeah, I mean the whole thing, top to bottom. The top line things that I loved watching this movie, one, I didn't really figure it out on the first go, and I figured it out at like usually when I figure out why I love a movie or what, it's either shortly after having seen the movie or you know, like on the walk home or something like that, or many years down the line when I watch it again just by chance. And this one, I was just sort of I think I went like a week between screenings and couldn't get the score out of my head, and then saw it for the second time. And like by the 7-minute mark, I was like, that's why this movie's amazing. I love it. And it shouldn't have taken me that long to figure it out. But anyway, I was just sort of in my head for a while. But the things that jumped out at me that I thought were really cool are sort of the almost the, I mean, this is one of the most famous Americans ever who wasn't a president, you know, like,
yeah.
So just that making a biopic about that and sort of not mythologizing him too much, like it's just sort of a human, just humanistic portrayal. And also we don't get a lot of answers from him. It also happens that the man playing him is the one of the best at being compelling and silent simultaneously in Hollywood. And the other thing I really enjoyed was something that I had never really thought about. You know, you just sort of take the whole space program for granted. I remember thinking the first time I saw this movie while watching it, like, oh, I think if I was 30 in the 1960s, I would have thought this was a bad use of resources, like government resources. And I stand by it. I still think I would have been like, this is weird. Why are we doing this? It feels right. I wouldn't be like Kurt Vonnegut complaining about a lack of a habitable New York City. But I don't know, between the loss of lives that are required to get to the moon and the incredible amount of funds. Like, it just sort of is very, it's a very militaristic sort of, we should do this because we can sort of vibe, that I just, I imagine I wouldn't have been into, you know?
Yeah, to very slightly paraphrase John F. Kennedy.
is that a thing?
They use his famous speech in this.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I also went to Rice, so.
Right. Yeah. The lesser remembered part of that speech, if I have that correct.
Yeah.
I think you're right about the most interesting thing this movie could do is walk a fine line between mythologizing someone and making it as grand and epic as an event like this would be. Mm-hmm. And he did have a very interesting life, to put it lightly. You know, he had a very compelling story to make a film about, just between personal tragedies outside of his work, and then, as you said, there was a pretty high death toll in so many of the years that he worked on the various Gemini programs, to mm-hmm. quote this movie. Yeah. It's, as you said, just an extremely famous person, and to make a dynamic character about someone who says very little without, you said you would probably feel differently about going forward with this program if you're alive at the time. So to make a movie that sort of goes against your values but still have a central compelling character, I think is what this manages to do very successfully.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that it doesn't follow with so many biopic conventions, and you know, those have changed over the years, to the point where we're at now, where it's like First Man doesn't cover the entirety of Neil Armstrong's life, because over time enough people have tried to do that and they've all been bad boilerplate cookie cutter movies, and so you just sort of pick a part of the famous person's life to cover, because to try and cover the entirety of it is just a failed idea, flawed idea. And so it's got that, but it also doesn't make Neil Armstrong seem grand, you know, like even by the standards of a Ryan Gosling character, he is very quiet, you know, and very understated. And there is no like pounding the table and saying, I am the great man, and we must all remember me for these things that I have accomplished. There's none of that. And again, like for somebody who accomplished what Neil Armstrong accomplished, to be the first man to walk on the moon, like it's just, that must have been like so difficult to avoid. And to imagine somebody who would want to make the full go all the way with it, let's try and sweep the Oscars sort of version of this movie, it would just be a nightmare to watch it, you know, like it would be horrible. It would just be so bad. I think of the Bradley Cooper version of this movie, you know, like starring and directed by Bradley Cooper. And I mean, this movie also got crushed by The Star Is Born at the box office. They came out right around the same time. And it would just be terrible. It would be such a bad movie. And if you make a version, like if there are 10 timelines where a version of First Man is made, 9 of them are terrible, and the one we got is the good one. You know, like it's, I don't know, I think we caught a break.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting you bring up Bradley Cooper, because I think it's worth mentioning that this was, you know, earlier on, obviously a different looking movie, I bet, but a Clint Eastwood project that he wanted to go through with, and there's, you know, let's say one of your 10 timelines is that one. Mm-hmm. And I saw someone draw the line between this and American Sniper, you know, the story of, essentially this male American figure who, much less famous than Neil Armstrong, but...
Mm-hmm. I believe his name is Chris Kelly, if I'm remembering that right.
Anyway, there you go. Yeah. But the fact that that we're not sure.
Yeah.
And so you're right, because this is a small performance, even by Ryan Gosling standards. There's not the scene where he really defends himself. I mean, there's one big emotional scene right after the death of his daughter, which, you know, that's such an extraordinary event that it's not surprising that there's a big, you know, emotional outburst there. Mm-hmm.
A big by Ryan Gosling in First Man Standing.
At least it's a large emotion. You know?
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
But you're right. It's short and it's not soliloquizing anything. But after that, there's not much. And there's not even, you know, a scene of someone really defending him. You know, it's not as though he was just so modest and there's other people aggrandizing him. So they do really avoid that. And my understanding is that Neil Armstrong's children said that this was a pretty accurate portrayal of him, mm-hmm. And that they stand by it. And so, yeah, he's not some monolith perfect character in this. No one's praising him as a person who did all these things for all the right reasons. But it also doesn't go the other way. You know, we don't see that he's... I mean, you can talk about to which degree his emotional availability in his personal life mm-hmm. makes him less than perfect, but you don't see this as a bad man or someone who's doing this in spite of all his awful characteristics. He takes some of the, you know, you can point to Whiplash, you know, some of these much more negative feelings and forms of expression leading to greatness. This movie doesn't really seem to get caught up in that as much, I didn't feel.
No, it's sort of like his flaw as a human is being unable to vocalize his emotions. You know, that's like, but that can have some negative aspects to it. You know, you don't win Dad of the Year if you don't talk to your kids and
mm-hmm. or Husband of the Year or
yeah, exactly.
Friend of the Year, right.
Or burying your emotions at NASA. You know, and so yeah, you're right. Like he's not good. He's not bad. He's a human being, and that's sort of the point of this movie from top to bottom is to show him as a human being who accomplished something great, but also had to deal with a lot of trauma in his life. You know, so I just think it just sort of tries to paint this person whose name I knew before I can remember. You know, but just tries to paint him as a human being as opposed to the guy I learned about in kindergarten, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think central to his identity is just being part of a family. Now, as I said, there might be a spectrum of views about the way he handles his emotions in that family.
Yep.
And I think most of them, particularly in certain scenes, you know, mostly when his wife has to sit him down to talk to his sons, kind of straightforwardly, or even just not talking about the death of his daughter with his friends, it seems.
Or his wife.
Yeah, or, that's right, or his mm-hmm. wife. That's actually a lot worse.
So much worse.
So much worse. That's... even given that, you know, I'm 100% open to saying that there's a lot of terrible things the way that he deals with that, but central to his identity is just being part of a family. And I mean that central as the first man seems interested in reminding you of that fact every chance that it gets.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just not frames of him at home, or there's very few without his children running through or a grandparent or, this movie just never lets you forget that, you know, this movie's called First Man. It's, you know, he was the one who got to the moon, but it's so much about the different people around his life and how they're affected by this.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that all ties into that sort of humanizing and demythologizing sort of ties into the style of the movie. And I suppose I can't remember 2.5 years ago with crystal clarity, but I think one of the things that surprised me seeing this movie for the first time was just the overall style of it was closer to a Paul Greengrass movie, or sorry, like a mid-period Paul Greengrass movie, now that he's changed the style up, but than I would have anticipated in that sort of documentary style. The Maisel's brothers were coming of prominence in the 60s, I believe, and they were noted as an influence on this, on First Man. And Damien Chazelle talked about how they looked to movies that were not space movies. And this is pretty common with good directors looking for inspiration in a genre movie. You don't watch the genre you're making, because right. then you just remake a movie you love that deals with space. And so it's all about picking little pieces from other genres that you can use in your movie. And the movie just throws you right into it. Like the X-15 sequence at the opening scene is just incredible. Like, and that's where you sort of get, is this what this movie is? Where you're just like locked in this craft with Gosling, shooting this format that isn't very common in Hollywood movies, 16mm, and you're just like right in there with him. And the whole 7 minute or so sequence is just very intense. And I saw that Damien Chazelle looked to Saving Private Ryan as an inspiration for this movie, and I would think specifically the intro of Saving Private Ryan for the various craft sequences, or sequences inside the various crafts. And and I think it's obvious, like right from the beginning, as soon as you see that, and it's just like you don't know where you are. You know, you can tell that's Ryan Gosling. Chances are, by the time you're seeing First Man, you know who Ryan Gosling is. So you know he's probably Neil Armstrong, but you don't even know if he's going to space or just like where he is. You know,
it's I knew that was him. Like, I knew who the star was and everything, but I didn't know that was him in that first shot. Like, there's a chance it's somebody else.
Yeah, I guess, because he's wearing the opening scene.
Yeah, you just don't see him very clearly. There's not, like, the movie star reveal. You know, that's not what this movie's interested in. And I think it's a similar thing, but the same token that this movie... It does spend time showing the vastness of space, but especially right off the intro, you just get it's just a smaller, more claustrophobic space movie than you get sometimes. And it's similar to the way that this is more concerned about the personality of this person and the experience of those people around him rather than what a global event it is. Mm-hmm. And near the end of the movie, we definitely lean on that and you get that. And I'm glad they do that. It adds to the epic scale of it, and I think that it is just an important historical event. So I think that it's a wise choice there. But that's one thing that struck me, and I saw that Damien Chazelle said they couldn't enlarge any of these crafts more than 10%, even if it's a nightmare to shoot in it and the actors aren't comfortable.
Yeah.
And that feeling of claustrophobia and, you know, isolation, I think is another one of this movie's strong suits.
Yeah, absolutely. And to tie in what we're talking about, like the sort of wider look at the Apollo 11 mission as compared to the earlier sequences that we see, that's the only time we see sort of like a wide shot of a space shuttle is Apollo 11. You know, like for every other time that we're in some sort of craft with Neil Armstrong or other characters, we never see like the big wide shot. It always has to be, it's tied to their subjective, like what they are seeing, either from inside the craft or attached to the craft. You know, like if we're seeing an exterior, we're seeing an exterior that is like where the camera feels like it's attached to the craft, you know? And that's, it's cool that they do open it up for the biggest one, but it is I think, so important to the movie that they totally stick to that rule until that point to not widen out the movie at all. You know,
it's great. You don't get that shot, the sort of sweeping shots of the rocket out on the launch pad, or you know, that not necessarily a pan, but sort of up and down the, you know, the vertical length of the rocket just to show how big it is. They give us a period appropriate animation to show us exactly, you know, that's their exposition. They don't go bigger than that. And
I believe I heard that was inspired from a scene in Titanic that I don't remember, but
oh really?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we also get just well, I mean, it's pretty epic that it's two chalkboards for the other diagram, but you know, it's not almost that gigantic. Almost to scale, but you know, I agree, it's just they don't make that spectacle of it. It's these cramped small buildings, small rooms and hallways, and then these small crafts. And you know, I think that does a great job of communicating what that experience is like, I imagine, of you know, having to spend a long amount of time in these very confined spaces. But again, speaking to making it smaller in the sense of the visuals, but also of the story and focusing on this person. And I think that it's amazing that we get all that, but we also get some very awesome special effects and some amazing IMAX. And by the time that they do give us some of that stuff outside of the spacecraft and that initial scene for sure hooks you, while still doing a lot of this very confined thing and, you know, not having a light in the astronaut's helmet, which is something that tends to happen in space movies. That is just not the way things would work in space, but it's just, it's so integral to see your A-list celebrity's face. But this movie sort of skirts that, which I think pays off so well, especially when they do start giving it more of a macro view.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I hadn't thought about it. I hadn't thought about the light in the helmet thing, but you're totally right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the special effects. I think
we've been talking about how small and little this is while kind of ignoring some very big music and big visuals.
Well, yeah, but it's sort of the rooted in practicality sort of special effects, right? Like the something that I found very interesting about this movie, and certainly not the first time it's been done. I think I remember the 2013 Tom Cruise movie Oblivion, the first movie that I heard about doing something like this, where the set was basically surrounded by a giant LED screen when they were shooting scenes of the craft being in the air, or things that they just couldn't shoot practically without doing some sort of special effect. And so what they would do was basically show the clouds on the screen. And then so what that does is it allows things to stay more real than shooting it in front of a green screen. Two, it kind of lights the actors as well. And three, the combination of those two things allows for nice little flares and all of those touches of documentary realism that Chazelle and his cinematographer Lena Sandgren were looking for in this style of shooting. And the other thing that they do that's very important in those sequences, they don't have Lena Sandgren standing outside of a ship and just shaking the camera. They're shaking the ship. You know, right. And it's, which is similar to how the flying sequences would have been done in Dunkirk, the cockpit sequences. And Nolan's longtime production designer, Nathan Crowley, worked on this movie. So you can sort of, it's no surprise that the flying sequences and the quote unquote bigatures that they make, which is just 80% scale miniatures, are just textbook. Longtime Nolan staples, and all of those things combine to make it's very old school sort of special effects outside of the LED screen, but it's just it's a long time thing that we keep repeating over and over again. It's something I've heard Damien Chazelle repeat many times. It's like, usually with special effects, the best answer is the most simple answer, and you know, it involves more planning in pre-production, but you then don't have to do as much in editing other than touch up the images on the LCD screen, which I believe is what a lot of the effects in this movie are.
Okay.
Yeah, or the digital effects in this movie are touching up those images to make them look less like an LED screen, basically.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that all the action sequences, I think they all work, and there's not this sort of thing tends to happen as more years pass. This is only a 2018 film, but I just didn't find that there was anything that stuck out, or you could easily point to and say this is good, but this is the one problem here, you know.
Yeah I'm not crazy about some, like, I don't care. This isn't a thing that bothers me anymore, but there are some of the wide shots of the Apollo 11 launch where I'm just like, that's a special effect, clearly, you know? Right. And it's just like, it's just because this movie has set such a high bar for itself for the entirety of the film, you know? It's just, but it's not like I walked out of the cinema. It's just like, well, sometimes you only get 90% there.
Yeah. You've been vocal about some zooms in other movies. Does this just fall in with the sort of documentary style that would make sense from kind of more of a domestic documentary drama?
Oh, for sure. It's baked into the style, right? It's like when you're watching The Bourne Ultimatum and there's a quick zoom on Matt Damon, you're not surprised, you know, because you've seen 1,000 quick zooms by that point. And I'm talking about something in 5 minutes into the movie. But, like, yeah, it's just a part of the style. So it's the style is so jagged immediately that it basically sets the rules that there are no rules. And that doesn't really change with the exception of when they are physically on the moon. And that's when all of the rules from the movie are reversed. And that is very cool because yeah. you've been watching almost 2 full hours of this movie until until you see a camera that wasn't on somebody's shoulder. You see a Steadicam. Well, I guess it's probably a crane. And it's just like the opposite of everything you've been seeing, which is its own very cool stylistic choice. But yeah, anything, all of the verite stuff in this movie I thought was really cool. And I think historically, like maybe one of my favorite kinds of movies stylistically are movies that are like big Hollywood movies that then decide to make them like little documentaries, right? Like First Man, I've mentioned Paul Greengrass a number of times. United 93 was a huge influence on this movie, specifically the mission control stuff. And Traffic is another example of a movie where it's like, this is a Hollywood movie, but it's shot like the money is constantly running out. You know, it's just sort of like faking that we are a documentary. And I guess on every movie, the money is always running out. You know, everybody yeah. always wants more money than they have, no matter what movie you're making. But I do love that because it's this weird dichotomy that there are just aren't a lot of examples of where it is the people who are the best at their craft making a movie like they're still in film school, but with everything they've learned while out in the world. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
yeah, no, absolutely. And still a lot of those movies are kind of very distinct pieces that there's a certain tone to different parts of it, and they're both handled very well, but they are not the exact same.
Yeah,
like we're talking about how small and documentary in cinema verite so much of the domestic stuff in this is, and I think it's true. And I talked about the kids running around all the time already, but that would just be something that if you were trying to capture any of these serious conversations with this family, or you know, with the parents, that would just be a reality of shooting there. And so, you know, we have this very practical utilitarian verite style, but then the moon still feels so big, and it's such a stark transition, but that just adds to that, the grandiosity of those shots, either on the moon or in space.
Yeah, no, I agree. But continuing on talking about verite for a bit, like talking about how, you know, we were talking about how the thing that makes the stuff with the craft seem cool is that you're shaking the craft, not the camera. I think something that's really important to talk about with this movie is because when it's, I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but like bad attempts at cinema verite are so bad. like when they just don't think it all the way through, when they're just doing it as a crutch. And I think that the thing that people don't think about is that you have to think about so many different things. Like the idea is to shoot it quickly, but to prepare to shoot it the right way quickly, you know, like it's a documentary, yeah. you have to put a lot of effort into things like that scene where the families are sitting around the dinner table and the kids are running around and the dog's walking through. It's the Land of Edgelock scene where, you know, they have to tell the kids to run in, and the actors have to sort of play off of the kids running in. They have to not be thrown off by this dog coming through. They have to ad lib if a kid says something to them, like that kid, the scene where Neil and Janet's, one of their kids takes that squawk box and won't give it back to Janet, is just Damien Chazelle saying to that kid while he's behind camera, hey, go take that squawk box, and no matter what Claire Foy says, don't give it back to her. Mm-hmm. And then that kid just executing that and doing a great job, because that seems like a scripted scene. And but it also feels like a very naturally scripted scene. And it's that weird balance that you have to navigate of feeling real, but also putting thought into it too, you know? And yeah. something that was really important to the crew was being able to shoot 360 degrees of the house at any time, right? So the whole house was lit whenever they're shooting in the house, just so that if the kids are running into the bedroom and jumping on the bed, Gosling can follow them and it's still properly lit. You know, they have these big light sources from outside of the house. And so then you can just have the whole family run around and have fun, and just have Lena Sandgren follow them with the A-cam. And it's that sort of planning that just allows those moments of spontaneity to happen, because also the longer you can live in those moments and the bigger the sandbox is to play in, the more comfortable the actors are going to get within the take of being people who they aren't, you know, and that, yeah. Which is the role of an actor. That's the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know that this is scripted or not, but the moment when one of the boys tells Neil it would hurt if he jumped over this bridge, and it kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you see a moment of him processing it. It just feels very real and genuine. And, that, you know, just adds to this idea that this is someone who, this is so much of what his life is having conversations like this. And for someone who's so, I guess, used to being in control of all these situations, the things that come with having a family, and, you know, just having a conversation with your son, you don't know what he's going to say, and he says something that, you know, maybe doesn't fully make sense. You know, I just found that rang true. And there's a moment that I'm reminded of where it's after Karen dies and he folds up, you know, he's kind of cleaning up his office, or, you know, his desk. Well, it's shortly after the funeral, you know, you get the sense that it's the day of.
Yeah, I think it is the day of. Because he, like, leaves awake to go into his office.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, and there's people outside the window. Mm-hmm. And it's this little black notebook that we've seen him writing in, and just is tracking Karen, his young daughter who dies at the beginning of the film, tracking her, you know, her side effects, her reactions to this medicine. She's got a brain tumor that ends up, you know, that has by this point ended up killing her. And earlier on in the film, we see him, you know, jotting it down, and he's on the phone with one of his employers, I suppose, and talking about different, you know, there's a treatment up in Saskatchewan that he wants to try, and he's doing what he's done his whole life with problems, you know, like taking diligent notes and calling everyone and treating it like a science problem to be solved. And, you know, we know he fails to solve this one. And this is someone who's been basically promoted his whole life and done many things right, and a very accomplished, intelligent man. And it's this, you know, it's the crux of this is that he control so much and is so good at so many other things in his life, and this is the one major one that gets away from him. And I just thought that's, you know, the same scene where we see him cry, that scene that we talked about earlier, but him just closing up that book for me, even before he cries, I thought that was just this really great small moment of someone acting so antithetically, just because it's the problem is done, the problem got away from him, the thing that he was trying to prevent he was not able to prevent. And I thought it was just this very quiet moment before the big moment that actually did just as much to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the flip of that comes on the moon when he realizes that he did solve the problem, and he solved this huge problem. And the thing he learned about is that the little problem's still there, or the, you know, big and little, I'm using in film terms, but
yeah,
you know, getting
like we've been doing with the domestic story and the space journey story.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. And that's also when he puts Karen's name bracelet into the desk, and the path to NASA begins immediately, basically.
So
I think like a big part of this. Oh, sorry, just one more note on the Verite thing, and then we can move on from it.
Sure.
The sequences at Mission Control are what they did for that was tying into the having to be able to shoot 360 degrees in the house. The set design of Mission Control was that so that the lights, like the fluorescent lights in that room, are just good enough to light the scene, so they didn't have to worry about lighting for individual close-ups and everything. And so every character in that scene has their own script so that they could shoot the whole Mission Control thing all at once, so they're not picking off pieces, and that allows them to shoot it like a documentary. And I mentioned part of this movie was, or an inspiration for this movie was United 93, and that's what Paul Greengrass did, was that everybody playing somebody in any one of the many control rooms that make an appearance in United 93 is that most of those people were non-actors, just going off a script of what they would be doing in those positions. So they had scripts for every one of those actors. And I was listening to the editor talk about it, and he had 24 audio tracks of that scene, because there are 24 people who speak in that scene. And so he just had an audio track of them going all the time. And I think that really pays off. Like, you can really see how they really crush the documentary aesthetic in that sequence. Like, it looks real. It looks like a real proper documentary. When, I think it was a year later, Apollo 11 came out, which is a documentary where they use 70 millimeter footage that had never, documentary footage of the Apollo 11 launch that had never been released to the public, which is absurd, because you have like the most gorgeous documentary footage of one of the most famous things that's ever happened, and it's just not available to the public. And Chazelle and company were able to use some of it in the movie, but you watch Apollo 11, the documentary on the mission that First Man devotes a large portion of the movie to, is, and you're just seeing things from First Man, but they're just captured in similar style. It's so incredible. It's such a weird experience to watch them back to back. But yeah, I just thought that attention to detail is another thing that you just need. If you're going to like nail the cinema verite style, sometimes you have to do a scene where 24 people have individual scripts, and Josh Singer gets really mad at Damien Chazelle for asking him to write all his dialogue a week before they have to shoot it. Yeah. So we've talked about the dichotomy between the big and the small, the home and the the moon and the family, which is basically how this movie is split up. And I think the movie does a really good job of intercutting those two elements at various points. Like, I think my favorite is when Neil just starts at NASA, and we have that it's to scale scene where they're in the classroom, and we're getting that intercut with what is Ed's wife's name, greeting Pat coming to welcome Janet to the neighborhood. And you're just getting the two different sort of responsibilities that they have, or the two different missions that the husband and wife are on, where it's just like he's on this mission to get to the moon, and she is taking care of everything at home, you know, but it's sort of, it's like equally important. And just the way that those two scenes are intercut is just really cool. And my understanding is, in the original script, they were written as separate scenes, and they just sort of found that it just worked together in editing. And it just, that's an example where it's like, it seems like you would have figured that out before you were in editing, because it just, it flows so well, and it's so important to tying those two things together, you know. And we also get a similar version of the same thing when Neil is in the Gemini 8, and it's intercut with his son raising the flag at home with some sort of mournful music happening because dad's not at home.
Right. No. Yeah, and I really I liked their scene together, the it's kind of neat scene between
so good
between the Armstrongs. It's nice, and it's you know, it's kind of speaking to one of the things we've been talking about so much, and it's he's speaking about the counterintuitive nature of you know, accelerating to slow down, essentially, and adjusting your orbit, and how it's, you know, really the opposite of what an Earth pilot would do, or the way that they think about speed and relative travel and all that. And I do think it talks about what we like about this movie. You know, you do the other thing, you know, you go really small to go really big for this to feel epic, and for this to hit you. You don't just go to one end of the spectrum and make it as big and high stakes as possible. You do a good job of doing both of these things, and that you focus on this personal angle, which is not the typical way to do a space movie when you have the idea of all this grandiosity at your fingertips. But that's, you know, as you said, the nine other versions of this movie would just maybe have more caps, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
just go bigger. And you know, this movie finds a way to do that the other way and make it more successful.
Yeah, for sure. And I think now's a good time to talk about Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy, who are just absolutely the anchors of this movie. And I I love Ryan Gosling. I think he's a fantastic actor. I don't think this is his best performance by any means, but I think this is like an impossible performance that maybe he's the only person that could have done as well as he did, you know, because it's just so difficult because you have to care about this person who almost never talks. And it's just hard to find somebody who doesn't at least like casually enjoy Ryan Gosling as an actor, right?
Yeah.
And you have to find somebody who can be expressive and emote while also not doing a lot of it. And there's just nobody who's as good at it as him, you know? And he's so watchable all the time. And I think he really fits with the sort of documentary, the verite style, particularly at home. That's where you see like a lot of personality come out. And, you know, he's done plenty of that style of acting before with Half Nelson and Blue Valentine being two examples that come to mind. But I just think he absolutely carries this movie, and so much of this movie relies on you just looking at his face and feeling what he's feeling, but he's not doing any big emotions ever. And like, that's impossible. Like, I just don't understand how it works, you know? Like, it's, maybe it is my favorite Ryan Gosling performance as I'm explaining the nuts and bolts of it, you know? Like, it's just so, he's given an impossible task, you know? And
for it not to be served up with the dialogue to express complex emotions,
yeah,
we'll say.
Exactly.
You know, I think of that scene of the two of them sitting the kids down, or, you know, her making him do that, mm-hmm. As she should, and have them explain that this might be the last night he ever spends at home on this planet again, or alive anywhere. And he gives his kid this extremely diplomatic, I'll say, answer about not coming back.
It sounds like a press conference answer.
I was going to say, just the press conference answer that you could imagine. Imagine him giving to people who aren't his young son. Mm-hmm. That's the scene I think of when you talk about him having to convey these emotions and without it really being on the paper for him. And, you know, the Claire Foy is excellent too. You know, there's a lot going on in that scene in every direction. And it's the scene that she forces, as I said, for all the right reasons, but then it becomes unbearable to her, you know, just watching this and have it in front of her and watching her kids start to process this emotion that she's been dealing with ever since, you know, presumably they've been together, or after his first colleague dies, mm-hmm. while they're together, if he even mentions it. That's what comes to mind when you talk about him having to do so much with so little.
Yeah, absolutely. And she is the one who gets the bigger moments, like the spotlight moments, you know, I'm Mark Ruffalo yelling in spotlight. Not the lighting is a spotlight, because that would be weird in this movie. But she also does have a lot of great quieter moments as well. And I think one of the quotes I found in research that I forget who it was, but it was one of the wives of somebody on an Apollo mission said something along the lines of, you think going to the moon is hard, try staying at home.
Yes.
And I think that's what Claire Foy has to accomplish playing Janet. And I think she does a really good job. And I know we just talked about this with Mank, but the sort of much smaller role of the wife of this important man that we're seeing this movie about can go so wrong so easily. And given her, Janet's relative lack of screen time, I don't think she's in this movie all that much.
Really,
if you were really to do the math, but I think that she, despite not having a lot of screen time and not really getting much more development than the wife, you know, that's the character that she is. I just think that a lot of the heavy lifting is left to the actor, and she does a great job with that. And I think she even shines more in her scenes with Pat than she does in her scenes with Gosling, because that's when you see a more individual story that you just don't get. I mean, they're always talking about their husbands, but they're at least talking about their own emotions, you know?
Yeah, and their experiences and what they've been left out of and what they know should be talked about and isn't.
Yeah, and Exactly. And she also does a really good job in the scenes that are clearly being improvised. Like the scene where I'm not laughing, I'm crying. That scene is just like, it's so obviously not scripted, but that whole scene is one of the highlights of the movie, you know.
Yeah,
it's just everybody is involved is doing a great job, and the kids as well. And I know you mentioned the sitting them down at the table scene, but the older son is really awesome in that scene.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, it's just the stare down he's giving him is incredible. So
no, it's spot on. That's amazing.
Yep.
And when she explains, I think it's the same son that your dad's going to the moon, and he says, "Okay, can I go outside?"
Yeah, absolutely.
another fantastic bit. And yeah, just that the kids are everywhere, and that in their conversation, they're, you know, even when he gives them, there's always say hi to your wife for me, you know, or talk about you, let's get the children together to play. They're just very real part of their life. That's not the space travel, but would occupy such a large percentage of their day and their mental energy. And I think it's appropriate that it comes through.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I think one of the recurring visual motifs in this movie, I mean, this one's pretty obvious. It's Neil looking at the moon, you know, like it's not like there's no sort of thought put in. Like, we've talked a lot about the Mary Tay stuff, but there is a lot of like classical cinema elements in this movie, and some that would have been really bad in sort of a more classical version of this movie, where, you know, like when early on in the movie after the X-15 crash, when I forget who it is who's talking to Brian Darcy James, but he's the boss before Neil goes to NASA, and he's like, I don't think his head's in the game, he's distracted or whatever, and it's just this horrible line.
It's one of the first lines of dialogue, and the second time you watch it, he's a good engineer, but he's distracted. It could be the synopsis of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. That is it, right? He's a good engineer, but he's distracted. Like, and there are
almost word for word, if not.
Yeah, there are a number of those lines in this movie that just pass because of the style and the, I mean, top to bottom, just great actors in this movie, you know. And I just think you get past all of that because of a combination of the style and the performances, but. Him looking at the moon all the time, that's another thing that would be hilarious in the Clint Eastwood version or the Bradley Cooper version of this movie, where it's just like, oh, I've been hanging out with my friend for 20 minutes, gotta look at the moon, gotta check in, see if it's still there, like all of that stuff. And like, I just have a long list of these things, and usually you're seeing them reflected in his face, and I think that it's, it just sort of shows his dedication and his obsession. And I think they even add in a couple when they just try and throw one in editing when this is right after the swing set scene or at the end of the swing set scene, when Neil's walking in after Ed has mentioned Karen, and then he just shuts it down. He's like, all right, good night. Neil walks into the house, and then we get this shot of focus being pulled onto the moon, and it's not Neil specifically looking at it, but it's just reminding us, hey, you haven't seen the moon in a minute, you know. And it's just, there's so many instances of that, and as the movie progresses, it almost becomes more and more comical, like when he crashes that lander, and like as soon as he is on the ground, he stands up and looks up at the moon, you know. And it's just, but it works, and there's just something about it that when you look at this list of, I think, 8 instances, it's just so comical, but it works because, I guess we'll talk about the ending a little bit later, but the way that they tie it in at the ending just sort of makes something that seems like it should annoy me end up being really great. And it just sort of, it constantly reminds you of, especially the ones where you're seeing the moon or space reflected on, his own helmet. It's just like, he's looking away from himself, looking far into the distance away from himself at something else to ignore what's happening inside of that helmet, you know, in his brain. And I just think that the way that they communicate that really is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I guess he is looking at one of the furthest things away that he can see, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So, and the other thing that sort of ties into that is the constant placement of just barriers in this movie. Well, not constant, but a repeated use of barriers in this movie, specifically between himself and Janet, or himself and other people. Like that scene you mentioned where he's putting things away, he's in his office at his daughter's wake, and he basically closes the blinds, keeps the world out while he has a cry and puts away his notebooks, you know. And there are just a couple instances of that throughout the movie, specifically when after the funeral that he leaves for Patrick Fugit's character, whose name I forget, Janet is looking at him as he looks at the moon in the backyard, and she just doesn't even go and try and talk to him after he sends Ed away. She just turns off the lights and goes to bed, and it's like there's this barrier between them that wasn't there 20 minutes ago when they were holding each other's hands and she was saying, yeah, we'll go to Houston and it'll be an adventure, you know? And, yeah. And that barrier only continues to grow throughout the movie when he's shutting the door of his office while yelling at either his boss or somebody who works for Life magazine about a Life magazine article. Or when he's standing in front of the TV alone and she's just watching him, like they're in the same room, but they look so distant from each other in a house that couldn't have been all that big. And yeah. She just ends up walking down the hallway by herself, and I just think that I just think that continued reminder of the slow separation of them is really cool and done well visually. That's much more subtle than him constantly looking at the moon.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and it's something that this is sort of abstract, and I know we talked a bit about it with Gravity and Ad Astra, that the very nature of space travel and, you know, this kind of astrophysics, I guess, is all about these different, you know, bodies, these different objects, and studying how they travel. And we get the sense of Neil Armstrong doing that math on that circular grid paper, which I've never seen before, when he's trying to line up with the Agena. And you know, he's just this very brilliant person when it comes to engineering and physics. And space is about being very exact about how to bring things together, you know, the rendezvous docking scene, and you know, just orbiting all together and getting to the moon and tracking these things, you know, geographically in space. And it is fundamentally about bringing things together and learning how they separate and why. And I always find that such an interesting way to look at this, because it is so abstract and lends itself so easily to these amazing grand visuals, mm-hmm. While also telling this really intimate story. And these science questions that are, you know, this person moving this way at this speed and someone else moving this way at this speed, you know, in this very macro sense, is just about separation and about the distances that are created between people. And this, you know, this is so much of what this movie is about at its core. And it's always great when there is a vision like that that is, you know, told through this one lens in a very interesting way while illuminating, you know, that micro aspect. And I think that, you know, I've said a lot of things about this movie doing two very different things well, and that's what that makes me think of.
Yeah, that's a good point. So going to one of the more macro things that this movie does is when it's sort of like we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, where, you know, you just sort of realize, two of the things that I think this movie does really well is the whole I wouldn't have been okay with NASA just as a general concept. Like I don't know that I would have loved the whole going to the moon thing, and also the way that subjectivity allows us to see how rickety these crafts are, specifically the way that the Gemini 8 is shot from that sort of POV shot of Neil going into the craft, and that's the does somebody have a Swiss Army knife, because there's a little bit of gunk stuck in the and then he's just looking around, hearing the sounds of these rattling of the spacecraft, and looking at just screws that are probably holding together this desk that I'm using right now too, you know, like it's just this very basic stuff, that sort of tying it into the world that you realize despite the fact that it's NASA and the crafts that they were sending up into Earth is, I mean, there were a bunch of boys building models out of balsa wood, you know, and it's just, I think that sort of not humanizing element, but just sort of like making the space shuttle seem like something that I can imagine the various pieces that come together to build a thing that would go to the moon. I think the way that it sort of attaches it, projects that to a regular person is really cool. And then the way that
just one thing about the subjective experience of that launch too, the way that maybe this isn't the same launch, but the way he puts that small mirror up, like he literally can't see where he's going. He has no perception of what's going on around him. Mm-hmm. He's traveling as fast as any human has presumably traveled at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he literally can't see where he's going, and at this point has no control over where he's going. And just speaking to the extreme lengths that these people go to and the power that they give over to other people. I think it's a good point that just the lack of... We're so tied into his point of view that we just get a small scene, a small percentage of the screen devoted to this reflection of outdoors through this mirror, mm-hmm. through the spaceship window. That's another barrier, another bit of mediation between him and this grander thing.
Yeah, and I think that's the Apollo 11 launch. And then I think pretty much immediately after that, he looks out the window at the moon. But the other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly, because I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on the Whitey's on the Moon sequence, the Gil Scott-Heron spoken word track that exists in this movie, because they get a lot done in a very short amount of time. But I wonder, is it like, are they trying to cram too much into that sequence and don't really properly address any of it? Or is it an accomplishment that it's just making me think differently about this moon mission, you know, Apollo 11?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. I think it's really interesting because I think the sequence is very good.
Musically, it's a great sequence.
I think it's great. I think, but I think your question's good. Like, is it just giving the beliefs of a lot of people at the time, and you know, presumably you at that time, admittedly, short shrift. I know what you mean, and I think that we were sort of resistant to some of these ideas in Forrest Gump. You know, this idea that it is kind of telling a sort of conservative story in a straightforward way, but here's some music and a couple images and a few sentences speaking to the counterculture at the time. And is it sort of just hijacking that, or, you know, as I said, giving it short shrift, just addressing it just enough and moving on? And I really don't know. I know that the sequence is very compelling.
Yeah.
I know that musically it's very interesting. And after...
Well, and intercutting it with cutting between archival footage and Leon Bridges is Gil Scott-Heron, and NASA preparing for the launch, like all of those things are happening. It's intercut in probably a minute and 30 seconds. You know, it's just a lot, and it's very engaging. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's a really interesting way to get us from the micro to the macro, because there is this kind of middle ground. And yeah, as you said, it's probably only 90 seconds, but it's a very memorable part of this. Let's say we have this, and it's not perfect right down the middle, because there's been intercutting between the domestic side and the space side of this, the sort of two halves of Neil's life throughout the movie. But let's say at one end there is his family life and, you know, maybe even the smaller training stuff at NASA. And on the other side, we have some of those grander views with whatever special effects do exist in this movie. But when they get on the moon and things cut out and the audio cuts out and the moon feels very big and, you know, imposing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they do that very successfully. But so between those two ends of the spectrum, we have sort of the micro macro. We have how this gigantic event is affecting other people. And by affecting other people, we talk about these protesters who, and, you know, these artists and musicians and poets who see how something so big is having effect on other people, and not just Neil Armstrong and not just Neil Armstrong's wife and children and the people who he works with, but all of them. You know, we'll start with the other people who died during this program, but then all of the people who died or had their lives made worse by not having the money mm-hmm. diverted towards the social safety net that was such a large number that went towards this program, right? So I think that it is incredible that that short sequence has that much of effect and brings that many other things into question and provides this bridge between the small and the big by exposing the macro effects or the micro effects on a macro amount of people.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I do think this movie is better for having that sequence, because I do think that that is about when I came to the realization that I wouldn't have loved NASA in the 1960s. But right. But yeah, I don't know. It's just something, and especially like it felt like maybe sort of a reaction to some backlash that was received off of La La Land, and in that it's a movie about a white person saving jazz, to quote an SNL joke. But yeah. Just sort of some sort of, I don't know. It's just there's just something about it that I haven't figured out yet, and I do think that the movie is better without it. But I just think that it's sort of the version of First Man where they like do a lot of man on the street interviews about whether or not the space program should be shut down isn't interesting, you know, like it's not a fun movie. So, and right. I don't know. It's just, it's one of the few things that I really don't have figured out about this movie. So I just wanted to ask about it. But that does tie into something that, something else I would definitely want to talk about with this movie is the use of music and how the music ties yeah. everything together, because I think like the landing, which is the sequence of Neil piloting the lander to land on the moon, is like about as good of a piece of score that can exist in a movie, because it's incredible. Just purely musically, it's incredible. The rhythm of it is just great, and it's the biggest piece of music in this movie that doesn't have a lot of big music. It's very small, but it also plays its big moments well, uses its big moments to sort of communicate something to the audience. And the thing that I love so much about it, and the thing that the shot when I realized why I love this movie, is the shot when I'm seeing it the second time of Gosling closing that drawer with Karen's bracelet in it. And that's when the quiet version of this sort of mission theme, I'm going to call it mission theme. It's called on that track is called Armstrong Cabin on the score, but it's just sort of this repetitive theme for Neil's mission. And it's the first time we hear it. It's the beginning of, you know, his quest to sort of end up on the moon eventually. You know, it's right before he starts going to work with NASA. And we just hear it throughout the movie. There are two repetitive themes. There's that theme, the theme of the mission, and there's the music with the theremin in it, which is just sort of this sort of spacey thing that sounds like kind of a human voice, but it's also electronic. And it's just this this interesting combination of the real and something that seems unreal, you know?
The all-time space instrument, by the way. the theremin.
Yeah. But yeah, and you know, we just hear that mission theme repeatedly throughout the movie a number of times, and but not as much as I would have expected watching this movie for the first time in about a year, because I remembered the score being extremely pervasive, and it's just not. But it just picks its spots to be really great. And one of my favorite scenes that we haven't talked about is when he finds out the mission to that they're on for Apollo after the Gemini 8 sort of he thinks potential failure when he walks in with that briefcase, and it's just this really quick cut sequence, and Cyrian Hines says to him, don't sit down, it's gonna be a short meeting. And then they just, that the cutting in that scene is so quick, even by the comparison to other scenes in this relatively quick cut movie. It's so fast because he's nervous, like he's afraid of what he's gonna be told. And then the cutting sort of slows down as he finds out that everything's okay, and it's just this really cool very quick scene, but it accomplishes a lot of that sort of subjective feeling, what he's thinking. And what happens is, as soon as he finds out they're onto Apollo, that mission's theme starts again. You know, it's just like, we're stepping up, we're continuing with this, you know. And even when he's packing, that scene where Janet is saying, no, you have to tell the boys that you might not come home, all these things, it's not the mission theme, but it's a combination of a number of pieces that we've already heard, and you can hear a very light version of that mission theme playing within it. And it's it's just this great little cue, and something that I only heard by chance because I happened to be watching it on headphones last night, and I never would have heard it otherwise. And it's this really great decision. But then you get to the land, like when he sort of detaches from the ship that Michael Collins has left on, or Apollo 11, I guess. And that just 5 minute sequence, that is just so intense. And the thing that, there's this really big John Williams moment in the score, and it's so cool because it's so counterintuitive to when you expect the quote unquote John Williams moment to happen, because this movie, which we should point out, is executive produced by Steven Spielberg, a guy who sort of like beat all of these horrible things into Hollywood's brain, and that we're supposed to tell people what to think with really loud music and shots of people looking and emoting and things. Which this movie is basically like dialing down the volume on a Spielberg movie over and over again. But that big hit where the music has never been bigger. The beginning of this music cue is just a repeat of the same, I would assume, notes of the quieter version of this theme, but now it's just with a big 94-piece orchestra. And Neil's very determined. We get, again, like this really good use of subjective cutting of just four really fast cuts of him like turning off that alarm that's going off, that's sort of wigging out Buzz. And we just four cuts that get that are all very quick, and each gets a little bit closer to Neil's face. And then we get just this hard cut to the widest shot in the movie, and you just see the speck of the lander. And that's when the music is as big as it ever gets. And it's all you're seeing is this vast expanse and of the moon. And what you're seeing is Neil accomplishing the mission. You're hearing the sound of a mission being accomplished, and it is the saddest goddamn thing in the world because it's just nothing. There's just nothing. It's just a thing that he had focused on, that he was about to land on, and it's just, it doesn't matter. It's just this little thing. And I think that the way that this movie uses music to carry it throughout, and then just absolutely like, it's like a knife. It just cuts so fast on that edit. And it's just, it makes me so sad every time. And then this is even before any of the moon stuff, but I just thought that the use of music is so good in this movie. That sequence is amazing. And that they're able to pack basically everything that we've been talking about into one edit of something that doesn't have dialogue. It's pure just music and visuals, and it is able to combine the thing that we just have joked about him constantly looking at in the moon, the barriers that he's sort of putting himself between himself and other people, and that he has literally left the planet, and just a repeat of a bigger version of a repeated theme throughout the movie. And I just think it's so beautiful, and it's like, you feel it even, and you don't necessarily process it intellectually immediately, but you can feel it, and it's just beautiful. It's incredible. It's one of my favorite edits in any movie ever.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%, and I think that you're right in that anything that can be a summation of about every other good thing in that movie. You know, it's good in isolation, just because it's great filmmaking. But yep. when all of that's been layered on top of it, yeah, sometimes you can't even process what it is at the time, just because what it's presenting to you right away is so dynamic and so interesting. And then to have done all those other things right along the way, I think, is what sort of makes it transcend, right?
Exactly. No, you're exactly right. And the other thing that I guess we didn't mention is that, like, you know, this moment's coming. There's no suspense.
Yeah.
You know, like, nope. And that's just like, it makes it even more impressive, the sequence, because you're still just so wrapped up into it, because it's just, they're nailing everything. You know?
Yeah, and I remember. You remember when the 1201 and 1202 alarms are going off, mm-hmm. and you know, this is the moment you're talking about. He's turning them off, and it never gets explained what those things are. You know, this is just chaos that has to be, you know, dealt with. And those alarms are actually for too much information. You know, it's when your system's overloading that their input devices are receiving too much for it to calculate and give out an accurate representation of what it's being fed. And that never gets said in the movie. I was so fascinated to learn that, but it's what you're speaking about. It's this total influx of things that the best form of it is to go to sort of nothing. You know, it's so much, there's this maximalist sort of scope to it, and then the edit to go outside and for things to be quiet again and for the goal to have been accomplished, and you know, just the busyness of it all to be behind, and he's sort of achieved this peace and solitude by being as far away from everyone as he possibly can be, that any man has ever, you know, ever been able to achieve. And there is that, finally, this avenue for his, I don't know, peace or you know, transcendental moment, some true sense of solitude that seems to bring him any sort of joy, or at least the ability to come to terms with some of the greater sadnesses, mm-hmm. if not joy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I think it's sort of the sequence of them actually being on the moon after having landed, and he gets to have his moment by the crater, sort of continues on that, where, and continues on with the whole, like, combining things that we have seen repeatedly throughout the movie with something that we haven't seen in a long time in the movie, where we see this bracelet that we haven't thought about. We probably assumed it goes in that drawer and we never see it again, and it has been at least 100 minutes of screen time since we've seen it. And it's just like his reveal of that he has brought it with him is just like I think that's really a really powerful moment. And then that we also see the reflection of the Earth in his visor, we see him and then cut to him looking at the Earth, and it is now exactly as far as the moon was when he was on the Earth looking at the moon.
And kept looking at the moon over and over. Yeah,
exactly.
And coming this far doesn't allow him that separation in any meaningful sense.
Exactly. You've just created a new problem for yourself. You know, you've just created a new distance. And I think, again, combining those, we're talking about that sort of like him, the repeated visual of him looking at the moon, the repeated visual of us seeing him looking at things, both like reflect in his face and otherwise, and then combine that with the reveal of this bracelet that we haven't seen repeated times. There's not the scene of him going to his desk and just popping open the drawer and being like, hey, remember this? You know, they don't even, Karen isn't mentioned all that often in the movie by movie standards. You know, it's like one of the more textbook Hollywood moments in this movie, the he's distracted moment, is when Ed says after Neil brings up Karen on that swing set conversation, Ed says, Karen, that's your daughter. You know, like that's just sort of like a reminder for the audience. And it works, you know, but it's like there are a couple really small reminders throughout this movie, but there's not a reminder of the physical bracelet. And it's not like the bracelet is a big part of the movie. We see it two times. We see him put it in the drawer and we see him drop it in the crater. And it's,
I think she, or, I think
yeah, Claire, actually we do see it a couple more times.
She
actually.
Has it. Yeah. I think just once more, but no, you're right. It's, there is a version of this where he's holding it in his hand during blast off. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think seeing all those things come together and at a time when, like we pointed out in passing earlier, all of the stylistic rules of the movie are being reversed for this sequence, you know, in the IMAX, everything static or just floating cameras. I just think all of that works so well. And the, something that I love about this movie, I love the last scene of this movie. It falls in line with the long history of me being in a movie theater, hearing somebody near me say "what" as something cuts to black. Anytime that happens, I love the ending of a movie. Because we get them all in quarantine, or him, Buzz, and Michael Collins in quarantine, and him seeing Janet for the first time after he's back on Earth. And again, we're getting these sort of these, a combination of things that are repeated visual ideas that have existed throughout the movie, in that there's a barrier between them. There's a physical barrier between them. And they're reaching out to touch each other through, you know, the hand on the glass thing. They're just not saying anything to each other because they've continued to grow apart. And even when they're kind of in the same room, there's like, there's just this big physical thing standing between them. And in the last shot of the movie, that sort of two shot, you can see her face reflected in the glass over his head, which is exactly how we've seen the moon repeatedly throughout the movie. And it's now like his focus on the moon has made her emotionally as far away from the moon as the physical I guess the physical moon was for so long. And I just think that's such an incredible way to end this movie, of just like, this is a quote unquote great important man, and the ending of the movie is him figuring out that he'll never figure everything out, you know. And it's just like, it's incredible. It's so cool, and it's such an incredible stylistic ride throughout. It's very entertaining, lots of good performance, like every, so many good character actors. Claire Foy's great, Ryan Gosling's great, and everybody just it's just a bunch of true professionals not playing with not making models out of balsa wood. They're no, using years and years of lived experience and skill, and it's just, it's so impressive. It's such a cool movie, and it's crazy to me that that scene wasn't the original ending, you know. There were supposed to be scenes in the script, there are scenes of them going home together, Deke driving Neil back home, and the shot end, or this last shot, was supposed to be of the Armstrong house. And it's just, I was listening to the editor and Damien Chazelle talk about it, and or maybe it was Josh Singer and Damien Chazelle, and they're just like, during shooting we were like, we probably won't need those shots of the house at the end. It's probably gonna end here, you know, if only because the performances were really good there. But it's a great ending.
Yeah, and as you're right, I think sticking that that last metaphor of this being a quest to solve one problem, and like everything in life, it's never your last problem. And perhaps that the drive and single-mindedness that he had in solving that last problem is what creates this gigantic next gulf between he and his wife that perhaps should have been the more important problem the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. So do you have anything else about First Man?
No. Do you have anything else about I Don't Want to Talk About It, the movie?
No, I think we've talked enough about it.
Okay.
We'll put this bracelet in the drawer, or drop it in the crater, I guess.
Yeah, I think crater.
Yeah, exactly. We pulled it out of the drawer to drop it in the crater with this podcast. So thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and check back next time.